picture this. All right. You're a young woman and you're studying osteology.
Right, the scientific study of bones.
Exactly. So you've just ordered this historical anatomical teaching skull from like a licensed antiques dealer in the Netherlands to help with your coursework.
Makes sense for a student.
Yeah, and it's not some illicit, grave robbed item. It's a completely standard medical specimen.
The exact kind that has like a removable cap held together with those little brass metal springs.
Yes, medical students have been handling these identical pieces for, well, over a century. So you're waiting for it to arrive in the mail, but instead of a cardboard package, you get a formal notice.
Oh no.
Yeah, customs has intercepted your delivery. The package has been forwarded to the local prosecutor's office, and suddenly you, just a student trying to pass an anatomy class, are the primary subject of a full-blown criminal investigation.
I mean, that is the absolute definition of a nightmare scenario. You go from being, a curious learner, quietly studying at your desk, to a criminal suspect literally overnight, facing potentially severe legal consequences.
And that very real, very terrifying scenario is the launchpad for today's deep dive. We are exploring the surprisingly complex legal, scientific, and frankly, fascinating landscape of owning human remains.
It's quite the rabbit hole.
It really is. And we're using a comprehensive, incredibly detailed article published in July 2026 by forensic expert George A. Rauscher to guide our exploration today.
It's an excellent source.
Yeah. So whether you are a medical student, maybe a history buff, or just someone fascinated by the slightly macabre realities of the world, this is going to completely reframe how you view the skeletons sitting in museum closets, or for that matter, on a private collector's living room bookshelf.
Because the line between a legal historical artifact and, an active piece of criminal evidence is far thinner and deeply more scientifically complex than most people ever realize.
Quite true.
The assumptions we make about bones are often completely wrong.
Okay, let's unpack this. The burning question that young woman had, and that you listening are probably wondering right now, is a simple one. Did she actually commit a crime?
Right.
I mean, is it fundamentally illegal for an everyday citizen to own a human skull?
Well, the short, highly surprising answer is no.
Wait, really?
Yeah. In Germany, where this specific customs case took place, and actually at the federal level in the United States too, barring some very specific Native American repatriation laws, simply possessing a human skull is not a crime.
Hold on, are you sure? I think most people assume that having a human bone is like possessing unregistered weapons or like illicit narcotics. Just having it in your house is the crime.
That is the common misconception, yeah. But legally, it just doesn't work that way. There is no blanket law that makes the mere possession of human bone a criminal offense.
Wow, okay.
I mean, think about it. If a law were meant to prohibit the holding of human bone entirely, every medical anatomy lab, university, and natural history museum in the country would have to be raided and shut down immediately.
Oh, right. Good point.
So, if you have a historical anatomical skull sitting on your shelf, you are not inherently committing a crime, no matter how uncomfortable that image might make your houseguests feel.
But Rauscher makes it incredibly clear in his article that this isn't some, Wild West free-for-all. He outlines three very specific conditions that make that possession legal.
He does, yeah. These three conditions basically act as the ultimate legal litmus test. First, the specimen cannot have entered circulation through a criminal act.
Meaning no one was murdered to get it.
Exactly. Second, it cannot have been removed without authorization from an active burial or an active custodial context, like an active museum or a modern cemetery.
Right.
And third, it must be lawfully imported or exported across borders.
I want to zoom in on that second one, the active burial or custodial context thing. It brings up a specific German law that Rauscher dives into, which is Section 168 of the Criminal Code.
Right. Störung der toten Ruhe.
Yeah, disturbing the peace of the dead. But he draws a really subtle distinction here about what the law is actually designed to protect, doesn't he?
It is a crucial distinction, and it honestly changes everything. Section 168 does not protect the bone as a physical, inanimate object.
Okay.
What the law protects is the public's reverence for the dead and the posthumous personality rights of the deceased. It requires an actual relationship of care and the legal authority to exercise that care.
So if I'm understanding this, it's sort of like the difference between owning a piece of antique decommissioned medical equipment versus sneaking into a modern hospital and stealing a working heart monitor straight from a patient's room.
That is a phenomenal analogy. Yes, an anonymous medical skull from the 19th century that has been legally circulating through teaching collections for generations is treated very differently under the law than, say, a skull someone just dug up while planting tomatoes in their modern garden.
Right, because the garden skull is an unknown.
Exactly. If you find a bone in your backyard, you have immediate reporting duties. The police have jurisdiction because it might be an active crime scene or a recognized burial ground.
Makes sense.
But an antique teaching specimen, disconnected from any active gravesite for over a century, exists in a completely different legal space.
But there's a catch, right? Because even if you legally own that 19th century decommissioned teaching skull, you can still find yourself violating Section 168, depending entirely on your own behavior.
Absolutely.
Rauscher mentions that the law protects reverence. Where exactly is the legal line drawn for degrading conduct?
Well, the line is drawn at how the remains are fundamentally treated by the owner. Rauscher uses a really vivid, somewhat unsettling example.
Oh.
Yeah, he says if you take that legally acquired historical human skull and decide to use it as a Halloween prop, say, by melting a wax candle onto the top of it for a spooky party aesthetic, you have crossed the legal line.
Wow, just from putting a candle on it.
Yes. You are now engaging in grossly disrespectful, degrading conduct. The anonymity of the skull or the fact that it's 200 years old does not protect you from a criminal charge there.
So the initial acquisition was perfectly legal, but the physical use of the object became a crime.
Exactly.
That makes total sense. You can own it to study it, but you can't disrespect it. But that brings us to, like, a massive, glaring logistical problem.
Oh, the paperwork issue.
Right. If lawful possession requires that a skull wasn't stolen from an active custodian, how on earth does a private collector or a medical student prove where a 200-year-old skull came from?
It's very difficult.
You see this debate raging on internet forums all the time. Critics argue that a collector should have to provide gapeless, perfect paperwork. Basically, a signed consent form from the deceased person saying, yes, I donate my body to science.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that internet demand for a gapeless consent form completely falls apart under historical scrutiny.
Now so.
Rauscher refers to this in the text as the Ramesses II problem. He points out that Ramesses II, the great Egyptian pharaoh, reigned until roughly 1213 BC.
A very long time ago.
Very. And he went to immense, literally monumental ritual effort to ensure his physical tomb would never, ever be disturbed.
He definitely did not sign a consent form for his mummy to be dug up, loaded onto a plane, flown to Paris in 1976 to be x-rayed, and then put in a climate-controlled glass case for tourists in Cairo.
Precisely. The concept of modern informed consent just did not exist back then. And by the way, Rauscher takes a brief detour here to debunk a wildly popular internet myth.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. If you spend time on social media, you have likely seen a picture of a genuine 1970s Egyptian passport supposedly issued to Ramesses for that famous flight to Paris.
Yes. The one listing his occupation as king, deceased. I've absolutely seen that picture. It looks so official.
It is a known digital fabrication, a total fake.
Wait, really?
Yeah, the historical record on whether any sort of travel document was issued to satisfy 1970s French customs is very murky, but that specific passport photo everyone shares is pure internet fiction.
That is so disappointing, honestly.
I know, but Rauscher's core point remains completely intact. Ramesses never consented to his display. Neither did the famous, incredibly preserved bog bodies found in Denmark. Neither did the Roman dead excavated in northern Germany, or the nameless plague victims dug up from European mass graves.
Which raises a really uncomfortable question. Why does the public demand that a private citizen who, you know, buys a medical teaching skull from a deceased doctor's estate sale, provide perfect, gapeless documentation of consent when the biggest, most prestigious institutions in the world can't do the same for their own displays?
It is a massive double standard, and Rauscher doesn't shy away from pointing it out. I mean, the British Museum holds over 6,000 human remains.
Wow.
The Smithsonian has well over 30,000. In 2011, the Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation took over roughly 7,700 skulls, many of which were gathered under highly problematic colonial regimes.
That is a staggering amount of remains.
It is. Now, Rauscher is very careful to distinguish between the necessary work of colonial restitution and the entirely separate category of medical antiques.
Right, they aren't the same thing.
Exactly. Returning systematically gathered skulls to a country like Namibia is absolutely valid and necessary. The institutions are doing the hard, expensive work of researching those specific origins to make things right.
But the underlying point for the everyday listener is that for a vast amount of historical antiquities, the absence of documentation is just the normal state of affairs.
Right.
It's not immediate proof that a modern crime took place.
Demanding gapeless provenance from a private learner while ignoring the massive undocumented vaults of major museums is hypocritical. Under the law, the burden of proving a criminal origin lies squarely with the prosecuting authority. An unresolved origin, on its own, is not a crime.
Okay, but paperwork is one thing. If you don't have the paperwork, and the burden of proof is on the state, how do we actually know what we're looking at? Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, the science part.
Yeah. Since we can't rely on paper receipts from 1850, we have to rely on the science of the bone itself. How do forensic experts like Rauscher actually read a skull to ensure it's not a recent murder victim?
It involves a meticulous process of forensic triage. Rauscher looks for three main physical clues. The first one is preparation marks.
Like how it was handled?
Yeah. He is looking for 19th century hand-guided saw cuts along the cranium. He is looking for drill holes that are placed in very specific, historically standardized positions designed to hold those metal teaching springs.
Okay.
He's also looking for period-typical varnishes applied to the bone to preserve it.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. If I'm a shady dealer, couldn't I just take a modern, illicitly obtained bone, scratch it up with an old rusty saw, slap some varnish on it, and call it an antique?
You could try, sure. But faking those highly specific historical preparation marks on a modern greasy bone makes absolutely no financial sense.
Really? Why not?
The effort required to perfectly replicate 19th century anatomical crafting would cost more than the skull is actually worth on the market. If a skull has these genuine marks, it proves beyond a reasonable doubt that it was a medical teaching tool.
All right, so the craftsmanship proves what the object was used for.
Mm.
But it doesn't prove when the person actually lived. To pin down a timeline, we need the second clue.
Yes. The second clue is found in the teeth. Dental boundaries act as incredibly precise historical time markers.
Like fillings and stuff.
Exactly. For instance, the invention of amalgam paste for dental fillings. That specific mixture was introduced in Paris in 1826 and in the U.S. around 1833.
Oh, wow. So specific.
Right. So if you find a skull with amalgam fillings in the molars, you know for an absolute fact that the dental treatment could not have happened before that time.
Meaning the person survived well into the 19th century at minimum. They aren't like some medieval peasant.
Exactly. And modern dentistry gives us an even narrower boundary. The first titanium dental implant was placed in a human patient in 1965.
Okay, so that's a huge red flag if you're looking for an antique.
Huge. If a skull has a titanium implant, you are undeniably looking at modern medical treatment. Rauscher explicitly advises that if a private collector sees modern dental work like a titanium post and there is no gapeless documentation, they should walk away immediately.
Because it's too recent.
Yeah, the risk is simply too high that the person has living descendants or was taken from an active cemetery where the legal period of repose hasn't expired.
It's like our teeth and bones are biological black box flight recorders. They're just quietly logging the history of human technology while we walk around.
That's a great way to put it.
But what if the skull doesn't have a lower jaw? What if there's no dental work at all? How do you date it then?
That brings us to the third marker, which is arguably the sharpest, and it comes entirely from the air we breathe. It's the nuclear bomb pulse.
You mean the atmospheric nuclear testing during the Cold War?
Yes. In the 1950s, leading up to a massive peak in 1963, global atmospheric nuclear weapons tests drove the level of radioactive carbon-14 in the Earth's atmosphere up to incredibly high, unnatural levels.
Right, because of all the fallout.
And that sudden, massive spike was recorded in the tissue of every single living organism on the planet during that time.
Okay, so if you radiocarbon date the bone, you can see if they lived through the Cold War. But hold on, you lost me a bit. Our bodies are constantly regenerating, right?
They are.
So if it's all the same skeleton, why wouldn't the whole skull give you the exact same radioactive timestamp?
That is the most crucial scientific nuance in Rauscher's article, and it is a detail that people, even some investigators, get wrong constantly. You have to know precisely which tissue you are testing.
Because different parts grow differently.
Because different parts of your head record time differently. Take tooth enamel. Enamel forms during childhood and adolescence, and then it essentially stops remodeling. It locks in.
Oh, I see.
So if a lab measures the carbon-14 in tooth enamel, they are dating the era of that person's childhood.
So the tooth gives you the birth year, basically. But the bone is different.
Radically different. Let me break down the chemistry of a skull really quickly.
Go for it.
A skull is about 65% mineral by weight, mostly a calcium phosphate called hydroxyapatite. That's the hard structural framework. But the organic part, the living scaffolding inside that mineral, is mostly type I collagen.
Okay, collagen.
And that collagen is remodeled and replaced by your body throughout your entire life.
So because of that constant recycling, the bone is constantly absorbing new carbon from the environment.
Yes, but it's not instantaneous. Because of the slow rate of that recycling, the carbon-14 levels in the bone actually lag behind the actual date of death. Depending on the specific density of the bone being tested, that lag can be 20 to 30 years.
Wait, really? So if police test a piece of skull bone, the lab results might suggest the person's biological carbon stopped updating in 1980, but they actually lived until 2010.
That is the exact danger of misinterpreting the science. And it gets even more complicated when you introduce anomalies like the freshwater reservoir effect.
The freshwater reservoir effect, what is that?
Imagine a river cutting through ancient limestone rock. Limestone is so old that all of its radioactive carbon-14 has completely decayed. It has zero left.
Okay, making it look super ancient.
Right. As the river flows, it dissolves that ancient limestone. Aquatic plants absorb that old carbon, and then river fish eat those plants.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. If a human's diet consisted heavily of those freshwater river fish, they are actively absorbing carbon that looks ancient.
Oh, wow. So if a 19th century fisherman ate river trout every day, that ancient carbon travels up the food chain into his bones.
Yes. And when you radiocarbon date his skull, the freshwater reservoir effect can make him look centuries or even thousands of years older than he actually is.
That is mind-blowing.
Right. Radiocarbon dating is not a simple clock of death you just plug into a machine. It gives you a calibrated probability interval, and it requires a highly trained forensic expert to interpret the mechanism behind the numbers correctly.
Which perfectly transitions us to the very real dangers of what happens when you don't use forensic experts. Or when police just assume they know where a bone came from.
Ah, yes.
Rusher shares a wild, very recent story in the article from January 2026, the Jonathan Gerlach grave robbing case.
Yes, this case made international headlines. Law enforcement in Pennsylvania arrested a 34-year-old man, Jonathan Gerlach, at the historical Mount Moriah Cemetery.
Right.
A subsequent search of his vehicle, his home, and a storage unit allegedly turned up over 100 skulls and various sets of human remains. The local district attorney held a press conference describing the suspect's house as walking into a horror movie.
And Rauscher, the author of our source article, was suddenly dragged into this massive media circus. Why?
Well, because several months previously, Rauscher had done a routine morphological trauma assessment on a single skull for Gerlach.
Whoa, back up. Morphological trauma assessment. In plain English, you just mean Rauscher was hired to look at the physical shape of the bone to see how it had been broken or damaged in the past?
That is all it was. It was a perfectly standard professional scientific assessment of a bone alteration.
Okay, so pretty routine.
Very routine. Afterward, Gerlach publicly thanked Rauscher on his Instagram account for the expertise. When the grave robbing arrest happened, the media scraped Gerlach's social media profile, saw Rauscher's name, and suddenly this respected forensic expert is receiving hundreds of emails accusing him of being the mastermind of an underground skull mafia.
Which is completely ridiculous. Providing a scientific assessment for a client doesn't magically make you complicit in their future unrelated crimes.
Exactly.
But here is the most important part of that story. Rauscher looked at the news photos of the skulls that the police had proudly laid out after seizing them from Gerlach's home. And what did he see?
What's fascinating here is that Rauscher, using the exact forensic triage we just discussed, immediately recognized that a considerable portion of the seized pieces were historical medical teaching material.
Just from the photos.
Just from the photos, even in grainy press images, he could see the historical hand-guided saw cuts. He could see the period-typical European varnishes and the telltale metal teaching springs.
And those specific markers definitely did not come out of an 1850s American cemetery.
Of course not. As Rauscher notes in the article, nobody buried in a 19th century American mausoleum had their skull cut open and fitted with a brass hinge prior to the funeral.
So if the local police just assumed that every single bone found in that guy's house was robbed from Mount Moriah Cemetery simply because that's where he was arrested, they are going to severely botch the entire investigation.
It is a massive failure of forensic triage, and the stakes are incredibly high. Mount Moriah Cemetery is massive. It has an estimated 150,000 grave sites.
Wow.
If law enforcement doesn't meticulously classify each individual piece based on its scientific markers, they risk feeding false, agonizing information to the living descendants of the people buried there.
That would be horrible for the families.
It really would. Investigators have to separate the antique European teaching skulls from the actual, tragically violated remains of the interred. You cannot just infer the legal origin of a bone based on the physical location where it was discovered by police.
This brings us all the way back to the young osteology student at the very start of our deep dive. Her package from the Netherlands was seized. She's staring at a letter from the prosecutor.
A terrible situation.
If you are listening to this and you ever find yourself in that surreal situation, what is the ultimate takeaway?
Rasha leaves the reader with three pieces of highly concrete advice. First, do not make a spontaneous statement to the authorities. Demand access to the investigative file first so you know exactly what legal assumptions are being made against you.
Always good legal advice.
Second, gather all your purchase documents. The dealer invoice, the online listing description, the email correspondence.
Now, you mentioned earlier that paperwork from a dealer doesn't actually prove the skull's 19th century origin.
It doesn't, but what it does prove is your good faith in the transaction. It proves to a judge that you didn't know you were buying something illicit.
Ah, that makes sense.
And third, hire a professional to classify the forensic markers of the bone. Having an expert formally point out the historical preparation features on a skull takes a few days and a fraction of the cost, compared to enduring months of mounting legal fees while a prosecutor spins their wheels waiting for a busy state lab.
So what does this all mean? We've gone from a seized customs package to the subtle nuances of German burial law. We've debunked the internet myth of Ramesses' fake passport, explored the biological black boxes hiding in our teeth, and seen exactly why forensic triage is the only thing standing between a botched grave-robbing investigation and the actual truth.
It's been a journey.
Ultimately, handling human remains, whether you are a senior curator at the Smithsonian or a curious private learner studying anatomy in your living room, isn't about who holds the right institutional ID card. It is about clean, careful, professional respect for a former human life, guided by rigorous science.
It is about letting the science speak when the historical paperwork is long gone. And I want to leave you with a thought that builds directly on the mechanics of that nuclear bomb pulse we discussed earlier.
Oh, I like where this is going. What is it?
Well, if the 1963 atmospheric nuclear weapons tests left a permanent radioactive carbon timestamp in the teeth and bones of everyone alive during the Cold War, what chemical signatures are our bodies quietly absorbing right now?
Oh, wow. That is a heavy question.
Centuries from now, will future forensic anthropologists be able to date our remains not by looking at carbon-14 decay, but by measuring the specific concentrations of microplastics or the forever chemicals permanently embedded in our skeletal collagen?
That is terrifying to think about.
It's a haunting reminder that our bones are not just structural supports holding us up. They are constantly, quietly recording the history of the world we live in long after we are gone.
Now that is a thought that is going to stick with you. The X-ray machine might not always give us a clean binary answer when it comes to the legalities of the past, but the bones themselves, they never stop telling the story.